I'm Jonathan Capehart, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Former Congressman Barney Frank spent 40 years in the House of Representatives advancing legislation on civil rights, immigration, and financial reform. He was the first openly gay person in Congress, became the first congressman to have a same-sex marriage, and in January 2013, he retired. In a new documentary, Frank reflects on his life and work in Congress and the impact he has made for future generations. The film, Compared to What? The Improbable Journey of Barney Frank, is directed by Sheila Canavan and Michael Chandler and opens at the Tribeca Film Festival on Sunday, this Sunday, April 27th. I'm very excited that it brings Barney Frank to the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you said that you were influenced by your family's political ideals. Did your family talk about political and social issues around the dinner table when you were young?
Oh, very much so. I grew up not far from here in Bayonne and in the 50s. My parents were both intensely interested. They weren't active because, frankly, growing up in Hudson County, New Jersey, during the Hague machine and the after effect, it wasn't very inviting. It was a kind of a forbidding place, but they talked about it a lot. We read the newspapers a lot. Back then, that's when the New York Post was still a real newspaper.
Right, when it was a liberal newspaper.
Yes, and a real newspaper, and a liberal one, and had some great columnists, Murray Kempton and Max Lerner and William V. Shannon. So I grew up in that atmosphere. And my older sister, Ann Lewis is her professional name, who later became the press secretary for President Clinton and has been a close advisor to Hillary Clinton. She's 2 years older than I, and she's precocious, and she actually got involved in the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign in 1952, and that got me involved. And there was another factor. Our father, who passed away, is what we would now call an early adopter. He liked to be on the forefront of technology, very much unlike me, because I'm not good with that stuff. But he bought a television set in 1940. People are surprised to hear that. But he bought a television set right around the time I was born. And I remember watching the key four of a hearing into organized crime. And then in particular, a few years later, the Army-McCarthy hearing. So television brought politics to me in a very real way, and I was always interested in it.
Well, let's talk more about your father, because he owned a truck stop in Jersey City, and it was one of the few, you say, where black people could spend the night. How did that influence the way you saw the world at a young age?
You know, people don't realize this. I learned this with my husband, Jim, who's much younger than I, and did not live through the 50s and 60s. And when we, for instance, see the butler or see help, and he continuously expresses his dismay at how racist America was. Now, it was obviously worse in the South, but even in Jersey City, under the Pulaski Skyway, which I guess has been the news lately, just before the Holland Tunnel, my father had a truck stop for over-the-road truckers, and it was one of the few places where black truck drivers could spend the night. You know, it was not just in the South, but there were guys who would be driving for thousands of hundreds of miles and have to sleep in the cab, the cab of the truck. And I was very proud of that. One, I was appalled to learn that it wasn't just in Mississippi where there was this racism, but also proud that my father was one of those who was breaking the barrier.
Now, you went to Mississippi to work on voting rights as a teenager.
No, I was 24.
Okay, you were 24. So what do you remember from that time? I mean, here you're this Bayonne kid down in Mississippi.
Well, this is a very famous time. Actually, we're about to have the 50th anniversary. It's the Freedom Summer. It's the summer in which Michael Schwerner and James Cheney and Andrew Goodman were murdered. In fact, I had left on the bus from Ohio to go down to the project the day they were murdered. We didn't know that at the time. We knew they'd disappeared. One, it was revealing. I knew intellectually what racism was like. I didn't realize there were so many people, black people, in America living. I know, frankly, you just had a very interesting conversation, obviously, about apartheid. Mm-hmm. Well, we had that. If you were black in Mississippi in 64, you were not any better off than a lot of the blacks in South Africa. You had no protection from law enforcement. You couldn't vote. I mean, there were maybe 10 blacks who were allowed to vote. they physically would not let you vote. They would go to the polls and they would give you this razzle-dazzle. And so that was revealing. But it's also, look, people grow up in this society and you have racist feelings. And there's no question. Jesse Jackson himself once acknowledged this, that if you're white and you're walking around and you see a group of young blacks, you get tense. And he said, even I get tense, Jesse mm-hmm. said. Well, what was very helpful to me was I was in Mississippi in the summer of 1964. And if we were walking along and we heard male teenage voices and they were white, we were scared because these were the racists who were engaging in violence. So it was a very nice freedom from the kind of learned racial responses.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first decide to run for office?
A very specific time. And I'm just writing a book. I just talked to my editor today who said, yeah, it's okay what I gave him, and he's ready now to edit it. In May of 1972, I was working for a very good friend, a congressman from Massachusetts. His name was Michael Harrington. And I had agreed to work for him for a year and a half till his next election. And two friends of mine who lived in the back in the Beacon Hill section of Boston, where I had been living when I worked for the mayor of Boston, called and said, the state representative, a moderate Republican, was retiring, and it was a district that they thought I could win. Now, I had always been interested in politics, but I knew I was gay from the age of 13. And I also knew that that wasn't going to work very well, that you weren't going to get elected to anything if you were known to be gay in that period. So I figured, okay, I'm gonna make a tough decision. I'll subordinate my personal life to a career. And I decided to run, and I won. And I won, frankly, in part. It had been a Republican district, but it was a district in which a lot of students lived from Boston University, MIT, and elsewhere in the Back Bay of Boston. And what happened was, first of all, we had the 18-year-old vote for the first time. And secondly, we had the man who helped me very much, George McGovern. And in fact, a lot of young people turned out to vote for McGovern. Now, obviously, McGovern got badly beaten elsewhere. But a couple of days after the election, I met him at a thing at Harvard, and I thanked him for the good influence he had had. And I said, you know, I won on your coattails. And some of his associates told me later that he thought I was making fun of him because he'd gone all over the country with people saying, you know, I was in sheriff for 20 years and I lost because of you. But it was the combination of George McGovern and the 18-year-old vote that let me win a Republican seat.
Mm-hmm. If you don't recognize that voice, then you're one of the few people who don't know Barney Frank. He's in studio with us. I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. And we're talking about...
Yeah, I learned early on that I should not try to make anonymous phone calls.
We're talking about... There's a film of your life that's out called Compared to What? The Improbable Journey of Barney Frank. So you get elected to Congress. You're closeted. You just said you knew you were gay since you were 13, but you knew that wouldn't go over so well. So how did being gay, closeted, elected member of Congress affect your new life in Washington?
Well, that's a very good question. I should start and say, when I decided to run for office, I said, look, I really had this conversation with myself. And you had to be careful back then because there weren't cell phones. So if you were seen to be moving your lips while you were walking, people thought that was weird. So you had to have these conversations internally. And I promised myself that while I would not be out, I would hide my sexuality, I would be a full supporter of gay rights. I didn't think it was morally acceptable to be something and then penalize other people for sharing that with you. So I did that. By the late 70s, I was so frustrated with the lack of a personal life. Look, people have said, I've heard people say, oh, well, so-and-so doesn't need a personal life. Her career replaces that. Nonsense. Everybody has physical and emotional needs, and you cannot channel them into a career without doing, frankly, damage to your career. And so I was going to come out in the late 70s and become an activist and be practicing law and be an ex-legislator with that credential. And instead, an opportunity arose for me to run for Congress very unexpectedly in 1980. So I said, okay, look, I can't get elected to Congress if I'm out. I mean, I lost votes because people suspected me. By that time, I'm 40 and unmarried. And what I did was to go to Washington and say, okay, I'm going to live a closeted public life, but my private life I'll associate with other gay people. But it didn't work. I mean, you can't live half in and half out.
And especially in Washington.
I finally decided that this wasn't working, and my personal life was making demands on me that I couldn't handle. I made some unwise choices because of it. So I finally decided that I would make the announcement. I should be clear. I was not the first member of Congress to acknowledge being gay. My colleague Gary Studs, a very courageous man, did it first. But he had been entangled in some unpleasantness. And he was the first to acknowledge that he was gay in the course of acknowledging that he had done something he shouldn't have done. I was the first to volunteer it entirely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were involved in some unpleasantness, the scandal about the man you hired as a driver. Now, how did that come out?
Well, the problem is that I was trying to live a life in the closet, and I was not able to form the kind of healthy relationships, either emotional or physical, that you need. And I did hire this guy, and he was very clever. He understood my emotional weakness. He figured out that I was just had this great. I mean, in fact, see, the very disparity was a problem. I had a wonderful public life. I was very successful as a member of Congress. And the disparity between that very successful public life and that dismal, lonely private life made me vulnerable, and he manipulated that. So I hired him. And I thought we were friends. He thought that I was a pretty good source of advancement. And he began doing things that I didn't know about. When I found out, I discharged him. It's not a coincidence that, in fact, I broke with him shortly after coming out. I mean, frankly, I guess he was angry. I didn't need that anymore. I didn't need this kind of relationship. I would now meet people openly. And he was angry, and he stewed about it for a couple of years. I mean, I broke with him in the summer of 87. It wasn't until more than 2 years later that he decided he was going to get even, and he couldn't blackmail me by outing me because I'd outed myself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that led him to, frankly, concoct a lot of stories, and he was successful in bringing them to the Washington Times. The Washington Times is the newspaper that was run by the Reverend Moon, and it never really succeeded on its own. It was subsidized by him, and it was the right wing's house organ. They thought that the Washington Post was too liberal and the New York Times was too liberal. They probably thought the Wall Street Journal was too liberal. So he took this story to them, and that's how it broke.
If that scandal that you were involved in broke today, how do you think it would have been treated?
Would you still have been able to survive? It's not something that I'm very objective about.
So in the documentary, you say, "I'm good at legislating. It's a peculiar business." What does it take to be good at legislating?
Well, let me start. I appreciate that because it's an important point. People need to understand the peculiarity. In your formal legal relationships with other people, not your purely social friendships, they are organized by one of two principles, sometimes both. First, money. I will paint your house if you give me money. I will buy the car and give you money for the car. We have commercial relationships where money is the factor. In other cases where there's an ongoing relationship, there's hierarchy. Somebody is the boss and somebody hires you and somebody can fire you and someone can give you orders. The unique thing about legislators is neither one of those principles governs our relations with each other. Legislators don't bribe each other. That wouldn't work, and 14 people don't even try it. And secondly, there's no hierarchy. There are 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. Everyone is formally legally equal. Some have more influence than others, but nobody in the House of Representatives can order anybody else to vote a certain way, show up at a meeting, or do anything. Neither can any of us in Washington fire anybody else. Only the voters can do that. So that creates a situation in which personal bonds, personal relationships become essential to being influential. And in some ways, it's like kind of being popular in high school. You know, you have to kind of get along with others and be good at what you do, but not appear to be feeling superior about it. And the peculiarity is to be able to work with other people where you want very much to influence them, but you have no power over them. And trying to work that out is something that some people are very good at and some aren't.
You know, I was going to save this question for the last question, but I have to add, given what you just said, and the institution you just left, where legislating, pragmatism, compromise, all seem to be dirty words. And just wondering if you think compromise and pragmatism are lost arts forever in Congress.
Oh, no, no, not forever. And in fact, it hasn't been that long. You know, people talk about the breakdown. Well, the breakdown is very recent, and I'll be very clear about it. It is the Republicans' reaction to Barack Obama. In 2008, in September, so that's less than 6 years ago, George Bush sent his top economic advisors to the Democratic-ruled Congress, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, telling Chris Dodd and me to work with them, and said, we're going to have a terrible economic problem unless you do some things that we knew were very unpopular, the TARP program. And the Democratic Congress gave George Bush a degree of full cooperation. We gave him more votes in the House than the Republicans did as a percentage. And you can go back before that. When Bush was president, he had cooperation from Ted Kennedy on No Child Left Behind. Even Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, while they fought about some things, still did some things. I didn't agree with some of them, like welfare reform. This breakdown has a very specific start in 2010 when the Republicans take over the House. You go back and you see a lot of very effective things through 2010. And then the Tea Party wing takes over. And they do not believe in compromise. And I'll give you one example of it. It was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. A couple of congressmen, Tea Party congressmen, went to see the Attorney General, Eric Holder. And they reported, he asked them to come in. They reported that they agreed with him that drug sentencing has been excessive, that you have to cut back on these long mandatory sentences. But one of them, Trey Gowdy, Tea Party congressman from South Carolina, then said, you know, we agree with him and we appreciate his reaching out to us, but we can't do this legislation because we disagree with him on so many other issues. And in particular, we can't work with him on reducing the drug sentences, even though we think we should, because he's for same-sex marriage. That is the definition of dysfunctional. Good partisanship, and partisanship can be important, is I disagree with you on these issues, and we will debate them. But we won't embitter it so that we can then be able to work together on the others. This Tea Party crowd takes the view that because they think we're wrong on some issues, that's the end of the game.
I have to ask you, because it's part of the documentary on your life, and it was a big part of your tenure as a member of Congress. You were the chairman of the Financial Services Committee, and in part of your what you were just talking about in terms of the Tea Party, in terms of when President Bush was in the White House, he sent his people over to Congress, you know, asking the Democratic House Speaker for help. From the perspective that you had as Financial Services Chairman, were you able to see the warning signs of the financial crash?
Not a lot, but I wasn't chairman at that point. Mm-hmm. I think one of the mistakes is, for instance, Dick Cheney in his memoir says in 2003, our administration sent Congress a proposal to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank killed it. Except I wasn't chairman in 2003. I wasn't chairman until 2007. Now, I shouldn't take it personally because, as you know, Dick Cheney has a very bad track record with regard to talking about 2003. He got a couple of things wrong, me and Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. But we saw the problems with subprime lending, and we tried to stop it. But no, there was not a general perception that the whole thing was going to blow up. We did think that loans were being made to low-income people that were a bad idea. And we, the Democrats, tried to stop them over the Republicans' objection, contrary to their myth. So we did try to stop them. We did not see how badly it was going to affect the whole economy.
I'm told I have time for one more question. I can't let you go without asking you about marriage equality and where the country is. Are you, very quickly, are you surprised how quickly the American public has changed, evolved on this issue?
A little bit, but I was confident that something was at work, and that is reality beats prejudice. Once we started having same-sex marriages in Massachusetts, the extreme negative predictions from the antis were so silly that reality undercut them. And I think this is one more example of how when people try to stop something by over-predicting gloom and doom, they are sealing their own doom because the conflict between the reality and their predictions will beat them.
Do you think the Supreme Court will get a case that will allow them to grant a constitutional right to marriage?
Oh, certainly they can if they want to. I think it's a very interesting thing. I don't think they're ready to do it. They went pretty far last time. They stopped short of saying there's marriage. My guess is that the criticals, the swing justice, Justice Kennedy, and maybe even Justice Ginsburg, and maybe Justice Breyer, would rather wait a little while. So I think this is interesting. I don't think the court wants to decide this right away, but you have these cases coming up from the lower courts, and it's going to be interesting to watch. I don't have any question that within 5 years they will have decided that same-sex marriage is constitutional everywhere. But I think they're going to try and stretch it out a little.
I've been speaking with former Congressman Barney Frank. He's also the subject of the new documentary, Compared to What? And Barney Frank will be in conversation with Alec Baldwin after the 2:30 screening of the film. That's the only screening on this Sunday, April 27th. More information is on our show page at wnyc.org. Barney, Congressman Frank, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.